The climate is changing. So are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, March 3rd on CBC Radio. Parliament's now on a two-week break, but the politics don't stop. First up, our Sunday politics panel is here to reflect on Brian Mulroney's legacy and two big pieces of legislation that were introduced this past week. After that, from airdropping desperately needed food to a possible ceasefire, John Allen, a former Canadian ambassador to Israel, will join us to talk about the war between Israel and Hamas after months of fighting. Coming up, you know him from his books like Tuesdays with Maury and The Five People You Meet in Heaven. I'll be speaking with Mitch Albom about his latest novel, which explores the timely themes of truth, lies, and the power of forgiveness. And later on, dust off your dictionary, because all of us will need one when we play an all-new round of our monthly challenge, That's Puzzling. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. It's been more than three decades since he was prime minister, but many of the political decisions he made are still being felt today. Tributes have been pouring in for Brian Mulroney following his death on Thursday. Tributes from his contemporaries as well as politicians in Parliament. The House of Commons is now on a scheduled two-week break, and when it returns, MPs will debate two major pieces of legislation the government introduced this past week. There is, however, no break for our Sunday politics panel. So joining me are Susan Delacorte, national columnist with the Toronto Star, Matt Gurney, SiriusXM host and co-founder of The Line on Substack, and Emily Nicolas, columnist for Le Devoir. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Susan, you began your career as a journalist covering Brian Mulroney in the 80s. A lot has been said about him over the past couple of days. You wrote a piece. You said he was, quote, simultaneously gracious, also a bit over the top. How so?
Much as the same way as all the tributes, too. I think it's still sinking into me that Brian Mulroney is not around, because I did write, he was larger than life. I can tell you, as a young reporter here, it was fun to cover him because you just never knew what he was going to say or do or what national drama was going to be launched by the day's events. And this was a time, too, where there was a sort of national conversation, much of it around the Constitution, which I was covering at the time. So it really was a historic time to be a journalist, and fun and interesting.
Emily,
and he made it that way.
Yeah, Emily, you have your own experience with Mulroney from when you were a junior fellow at Massey College. We'll talk about Quebec specifically in a moment, but how are you remembering the former prime minister?
I met Brian Mulroney in 2014. I was a junior fellow at Massey when Nelson Mandela passed away, and a bunch of students decided to have a lecture or lesson of history directly from the people who had played the largest role in that, and trying to see how the decision or the shift on Canada's position on apartheid happened. And so we invited Brian Mulroney and Stephen Lewis, who was at the time the UN ambassador, Canada's ambassador to the UN, And it was really interesting to see how that shift happened. You know, there's a lot of things in Mulroney's record in terms of human rights that do not necessarily align with that decision he made on apartheid. I'm thinking about the Oka crisis and other things. But on that, I remember very well Stephen Lewis himself saying, you know, the moment that Brian Mulroney stood up at the UN National Assembly and said that there would be essentially, they would be thinking about breaking relationships with South Africa and imposing sanctions if apartheid was not was to continue was a moment that everybody at the UN General Assembly saw as historic, especially the African delegates and the representative of African states. And so that is something that's to be remembered, and also made me think about, you know, what else has changed in Canada, is its involvement in international relation back when we did that in 2014, but also very much right now in 2024.
And what do you see when you say that?
You know, even back then in 2014, I remember I was looking at the note. I saw both Brian Mulroney and Stephen Lewis. Brian Mulroney actually said, and we have this on record, that if he had been prime minister in 1994, Canada would have played a different role in Rwanda, because he said we had done something about Ethiopia, we could have done something about Rwanda. Obviously, that's very much a lot of shade thrown at Jean Chrétien. It's a huge comment to make, and we can never redo a history like that with if. But they were both very, you know, seeing a decline of Canada's involvement in causes that are about, you know, morality and making the right stand. When the fight against apartheid, in that context, it was very much about standing up to Margaret Thatcher in the UK, who was a woman that Brian Mulroney admired personally. And I don't remember personally the last time that you know, a Canadian prime minister stood up like that to one of our allies, would it be the UK, or especially I think in this current context, the United States. Mm. And Joe Biden. And so for somebody that is a Canadian prime minister to stand up to, you know, a world leader that would have been at the same ilk of Margaret Thatcher today, I haven't seen that in a really long time. It's, you know, the name of our event was Principled Leadership, and what it takes to make that kind of tough call. I haven't seen this kind of tough call made, I think, in my own living, you know, memory. Hmm. Of course, I was alive at the time, but I was too young to be politically conscious.
Okay, Matt. So Emily's talked about Mulroney's international impact. You were also very young, I know, because we're dating everyone on the program this morning, apparently, when Mulroney was in office. But how do you see him having shaped conservative politics and the country we have today?
Well, see, and that's a fascinating question, because I think very much like Emily, like, I remember Brian Mulroney. He was not my first prime minister. I was born before he was prime minister. But by the time I was in journalism, he had already gone through his post-political transformation, where he had been prime minister, he had won the two conservative majorities, he had then gone through the obliteration of the party that he had run, and the period of the 1990s, where he was better known for allegations of financial impropriety. But by the time I was in journalism, he had completed that metamorphosis back into conservative elder statesman. And I just don't mean for the Conservative Party, but I mean for the country at large. And that to me was incredible, and I think it did mirror a little bit the resuscitation of conservatism in this country as a electorally viable movement. Like, it's always been an ideologically viable movement. A fairly consistent number of Canadians would identify as conservative. But, you know, during the 1990s, and Emily's already made the reference here, this was the time of Jean Chrétien. This was the time of liberal ascendancy, where the conservative opposition had fragmented. You had the kind of what was left of the PCs. You had the Reform. You had the Quebec wing breaking off largely into the Bloc. And it took a long time, just like basically 20 years, to begin to stitch that back together. I don't want to say that Brian Mulroney was responsible for that. In fact, I know that there were some conservatives who blamed him for the schism happening in the first place. But I do think if you want to kind of track the return of conservatism as a political force in Canada into being electorally viable, and then you plot that against sort of Brian Mulroney's post-politics trajectory, they don't line up perfectly, but boy, they do tend to move in the same direction, don't they?
Susan, Matt just referenced the Airbus affair. It was a big scandal for those of us who were sentient at the time, big scandal at the time. For those who weren't, Mulroney admitted to taking envelopes stuffed with a lot of cash from this middleman working for Airbus, a guy named Karl-Heinz Schreiber. How important will that scandal be when, you know, future historians look back at Mulroney's legacy, and how should we remember it?
I think we can remember it. I know people who say it permanently toxifies the legacy. I think that's a bit much. I think it will be a sad personal footnote. I think that's how I took it. It was a sign of what Matt was referring to, sort of the bad years of Brian Mulroney, when the immediate shock of 1993 and the once great Conservative Party being reduced to two seats and its prime minister reduced to doing some low-level lobbying with not altogether sketchy or sketchy kind of dealings. I think that's a personal, unfortunate footnote. I think I will say I think it's interesting. Both Emily and Matt have pointed this out, that the post prime minister, he is remembered for a lot of things. And I think we have to remember the economic legacy of him too, that is so important. I think though, what struck me as I've been watching all these tributes, and I'm going to get backlash for this, but how much Brian Mulroney's, when people say the modern Conservative Party of Pierre Poilievre is not your dad's Conservative Party, we're talking about Brian Mulroney's Conservative Party. All the nostalgia you're seeing, too, was for a very different kind of conservatism.
And a different country, too, at the time.
Yes, for sure. For sure. But I think it's safe to say that this prime minister had better relations with the current Liberal prime minister than he did or had with Pierre Poilievre. I think there's the blue Liberal and the red Tory, that was more of a force when Brian Mulroney was around. And I'm just not sure that Mulroney's legacy can be seen in the modern Conservative Party of today.
There will, of course, be a state funeral for him and many more tributes in the coming days. When that funeral is yet to be determined. But Emily, just before we kind of move on from talking about Brian Mulroney, I mean, he was the little guy from Baie-Comeau, the guy from Quebec, the constitutional efforts with both Meech Lake and the Charlottetown Accord, very, very important to that province and to the rest of the country. As you mentioned, he sent the military into Oka in Quebec. How's Mulroney being remembered in Quebec, or how do you think he will be remembered in Quebec?
He was the middle ground guy in terms of this generation of in the 80s and the 90s. That's very much shaped by constitutional debate. The Boris guy tried the Meech Lake, which was basically trying to have Quebec fit into the constitution and sign on the constitution. I will say though that we're saying how Brian Mulroney is remembered as the person who could, reach across party line. It was very much true in the example that I used with appointing Stephen Lewis as UN ambassador, Stephen Lewis being a former NDP leader. However, the big line, the big divide was very much his break with Lucien Bouchard and the foundation of the Bloc Québécois. That was the big, the big divide of the time. And we just all heard on national television when Brian Mulroney passed, Lucien Bouchard did come on television and talk about their very, very, very late and recent reconciliation. And so that also, I think, speaks to me to the depth of the wounds in Quebec nationalism, in Quebec politics to this day on that generation that was essentially how close that referendum was and how there's still resentment on that is hard to quell for that generation. And more and more of the protagonists of that generation are either, you know, passing away and or aging. And so, but there's something about that page of history that we were reliving, you know, on Radio-Canada when people, you know, Jean Charest and Lucien Bouchard were remembering Brian Mulroney. There's something about that that is about, you know, oral history of that page of Canadian history, essentially. Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us this morning, I'm joined by our Sunday Politics panel. That was Emily Nicolai. You were just hearing there, as well as Susan Delacourt and Matt Gurney. Matt, you know, this past week, as I mentioned off the top, there are two major pieces of legislation put forth, and I actually want to, hopefully we'll have time to talk about both of them. So first, let's talk about PharmaCare. This is a deal the Liberals negotiated with the NDP. The NDP demanded it in exchange for continuing to support the government. So this is just the first step of a national program with two classes of drugs being covered. But Matt, in terms of the politics of this, how big of a win is this and for who?
You see, that's a really interesting question because I've actually been thinking about the politics of this for, well, since it was announced. And I mean, in terms of who it's a win for, let's start with the obvious. It's a win for the people who's did not have access to either a provincial or a private drug plan, who will now save some money accessing drugs that either make their lives better in the case of contraception, or in the case of diabetes, allow them to have a life. So, like, there are real Canadians who are going to benefit from this, and we shouldn't overlook that. But what I was struck by when this was announced was, with all respect to those Canadians, the fairly limited scope of this. The NDP have been talking for many, many years about their aspirations for a sweeping universal PharmaCare plan. And what we got was not that. What we got was, you know, I think as you just said, Bea, like what we got is what they're calling a first step. Yeah, it's a first step, but it's a very modest first step. And I've been wondering about that. We all know, we all saw that the NDP had very publicly said, Jagmeet Singh, the leader himself, had gone out and said that if they didn't get a deal on this, if there wasn't progress, then the NDP was prepared to walk away from their deal with the Liberals. So they were playing hardball in public about the importance of this. And what we got was fairly modest. And what I'm honestly curious about, and I don't know, like I want to hear what the others have to say about this. I don't know if this was the extent of the deal that they could come up with on short notice, that this was basically the Liberals said, okay, we've got a deadline to the end of the month. What can we slam together now that will keep the NDP happy? And, you know, we can worry about the rest later. Or the other possibility is that this was simply as far as the Liberals were willing to go. And it wasn't an issue of timing. It wasn't an issue of pressure. But it was the Liberals going, look, we'll throw you a bone to keep you guys happy. We'll give you something you can declare as a victory in public. But we're not prepared to go any further than this at this time. I don't honestly know which of the two it is, but I would love to know because the politics of that would be fascinating.
Susan, why don't you chime in here? How are you reading this politically?
About the same way Matt is. I think that it is pretty modest to start, and it's very processy. The kind of political stories we all hate doing. There are so many provincial negotiations to have before this is happening. There's a committee to study the cost. It's pure Ottawa in that way. What really struck me when I was watching Jagmeet Singh take the victory lap on this, which he's owed, was how much pressure is on Canadians to keep this. What he is saying basically is you're going to get PharmaCare, Canadians, if you put pressure on your provincial governments to go along with this. And are we that kind of a nation right now that puts pressure on provincial governments to do more? Or are we a kind of a nation that says, look, we've had enough of governments messing in our lives? I think that's a big existential question that is out there right now. And is there enough time before the next election to make it a ballot question, as Jagmeet Singh seems to think it might be? I think right now it's lost in process. I agree. I totally endorse what Matt said about it. It will be very good for people if it does happen, but it's not here yet. It's an idea still.
Yeah, that's the big if, because healthcare, of course, is a provincial responsibility. Alberta and Quebec have already said thanks, but no thanks. Ontario says, look, we're mulling it over. So, Emily, I know every province has different reasons, but if we look at Quebec as one of the provinces, a major province, saying, no, thank you, why is Quebec Premier François Legault saying he wants no part of this? Like, again, what are the politics behind this?
Well, so there's already a form of pharmacare in Quebec. So federal involvement in that could mean essentially renegotiation with the private insurance that are responsible for that. But I think before people think that, you know, it's not touching them, or I think it'd be very important for people to understand how that works, and how when you do have that medical insurance, essentially if you don't, or if you're not insured by your employer, you do have that basic coverage that's coming out of government. I already know that what the federal government is thinking of is different from what Quebec already has. For example, everything that has to do with contraception, there is a minimal, essentially, price that you pay every month, and before or a minimum amount of dollars that you pay if you need medication, and above that, essentially, now you're reimbursed by the RAMQ. If you're only taking birth control right now, that's not reimbursed to you as a young woman in Quebec. And so there would be policy changes from what the federal government has announced, but it's up to Jagmeet Singh and Justin Trudeau and the feds to actually communicate around that. Otherwise, it also goes above the heads of a lot of Quebecers as well.
Okay, we'll wait to see if that big if becomes a actual piece of legislation if it passes through the House. A lot to come on the pharmacare debate and decisions. The other big piece of legislation that the Liberals tabled this past week was the online harms bill. This bill would introduce new rules for content on the internet around bullying and child abuse. Susan, you know, as a parent kind of watching this, you want anything that's going to help protect your children, right? So you're kind of like, well, this is great. Except for then you have, people saying it's not gone far enough. You have conservative leader Pierre Poilievre coming out swinging against this bill even before it was put forward, accusing the Liberals of attacking freedom of speech and expression. How are you assessing this bill politically?
I am thinking how unfortunate it is that an online harms bill is going to be debated online. You know, the very worst place now to have a political debate is online and about online things. I almost want to tell Pierre Poilievre and Justin Trudeau and Jagmeet Singh, don't talk about this online, because the very reason we need this legislation is playing out on Twitter or whatever, just really, really badly. Hmm. So I'm not looking forward to the debate about this. I'm not entirely convinced that it's going to be reasonable or nuanced. And I think that's what we do need.
Emily, how are you looking at this proposed piece of legislation?
It's really interesting what Susan just said, because in terms of the scope of the legislation, it's much more narrowed in focus than what a lot of people had hoped for, in terms of really focusing on, children's abuse, and which is something that directly falls into the kind of discourse that the Conservatives have been talking a lot about to do. You know, protection of children, protection of parents is one of their cue vocabulary, and so it's really interesting how even that is divisive. There's a lot of other questions in terms of, you know, what else is going to be put in place in terms of the criminal the criminal code. But I'm also seeing that just like any kind of violence, any other form of violence that we've tried to push against as a country, because a lot of the online violence and even the violence against children online is focused on young girls and young women. A lot of that comes down to policing as well. And so if those things exist in the criminal record, but it's very hard for young girls to be believed or young women to be taken seriously when they go to the police because of the harassment they're facing online, that's, you know, changing the things in the criminal code is not necessarily going to lead to a lot of social change. And we've seen that in the offline, violence against women and girls. We know that already. And so I do think that the bill is achieving certain things. But at the same time, if we think that the problem of online violence is going to be solved just by that, instead of a conversation about RMORs and an observation of the business model that is farming hate that is making people billionaires nowadays. I'm thinking about the online platforms. If we don't re-examine the business model and how it controls our life, it's basically a whack-a-mole game where we're just going to be trying to put in prison, essentially, or have amends against the people who cross a line. But we don't, we're not attacking the game itself and how it's been transforming our people's ability to have a public voice.
Those are the substantive issues that this bill is supposed to at least partially address. And as Emily suggests there, maybe it doesn't go far enough. But Matt, in the discussion, especially leading up to the introduction of this bill, it is being put in a stew of freedom of speech and expression by Pierre Poilievre and his party. Is this a good political positioning by the conservative, or is it a red herring, as critics have suggested it is?
You know, the interesting thing is about that, Pia, is I think it's both. And the reason I think it's both, and I'm not just trying to cover off every position simultaneously, I think the Liberals have proposed here 80% of a good bill. I think that in terms of both the politics and the policy, I think the stuff targeting revenge pornography, child sexual abuse material, threats of violence, things like that, these are real online harms. And I think the policy proposals that they contained within the bill to address them are material improvements. We all know, either through direct experience or at least having read about it, how hard it is to fight this stuff online, how little, few resources police have, to be blunt, often how little interest the police have in dealing with things that are overt criminal acts, but it happened on the internet, so we're not going to worry about it. If the Liberals were to pull out that stuff into a separate bill, I think it would be impossible for the Conservatives to oppose it. Like, I think the policy proposals are real. The solutions are proposed are improvements over the status quo. The problems are widely recognized. Y'all remember Vic Taves? You can stand with us or you can stand with the child pornographers. Like, the Conservatives could find themselves in the exact opposite position they were in then. They could be the ones refusing to support a bill that would actually make children safe from sexual exploitation online. Where the Liberals are going to get into trouble on this one, and where the Conservatives do have political opportunity, is in trying to figure out a way to define hate speech that actually covers the vile stuff that exists online and does not run up against free expression concerns here. No one's ever been able to do that successfully, right? We've been trying to do that for decades, and the reason we keep getting into trouble isn't because the people who tried were dumb or lazy. It's because it's really hard. That's the part of the bill that's going to get the Liberals in trouble. That's the part of the bill where the Conservatives will have an opportunity to attack.
Okay, lots to come on both those bills and, of course, the state funeral being planned for Brian Mulroney. More details coming soon. Thank you, all three. Appreciate you with us this Sunday morning.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
guys. You.
Susan Delacourt, national columnist with the Toronto Star. Matt Gurney is a SiriusXM host and co-founder of The Line on Substack. And Emily Nicolas is a columnist for Le Devoir. Let's now turn to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. It is catastrophic. There is growing starvation and disease. And after months of war between Israel and Hamas, the international community is now turning to airdrops of food and other aid to help Palestinian civilians survive. Yesterday saw the first airdrops of food by the United States. Canada says it too will be joining those efforts, but when exactly that might happen isn't known yet. And it all comes just days after aid brought into Gaza on trucks saw 112 people killed, many by bullets, and hundreds more injured after people crowded around the trucks. Now, Hamas says the Israeli military fired at civilians, but Israel says it only fired warning shots and most people died in a crush. John Allen is a senior fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. He was also Canada's ambassador to Israel from 2006 to 2010. John, good morning to you.
Hi, Pia. Good morning.
I'm glad to have you with us. I think everyone can agree the situation in Gaza for civilians is bleak. The international community is now turning to airdrops, which is something we haven't seen in some time. What is your understanding of how effective airdrops are?
Well, one plane drops the equivalent of about one truck. And it's generally agreed that what Gaza and the Gazans need right now are about 500 trucks a day. So this is not a real solution to the problem. It probably helps Joe Biden politically a bit, and it will feed some people, But it's not the answer to a growing problem of famine in the north and starvation in the south. They need a ceasefire that will allow hundreds of trucks to be coming in with food, medicine, water, etc.
We'll see if we get a ceasefire. Those talks are on in Egypt today, and we'll get to that in a minute with you, John. But just to stay with airdrops for a moment, we saw about, I think it was about 38,000 meals dropped into Gaza. It's a trickle, as you say, for more than 2 million people. I know it's just the start, but this is a Herculean task, perhaps a risky one too. What are the risks in airdropping food and aid into Gaza? You know, a lot of humanitarian groups say this is kind of a solution of last resort.
Well, we saw some of the risks where the British airdrop ended up in the part of it in the ocean and boats going out to try and pick it up. Another problem, of course, is who gets the food that's dropped. The strongest, you end up with a kind of Orwellian situation where people who can get to the food and who can get it off the pallets get it, and perhaps mothers with children don't get it. And there may well be some black marketing going on. You know, you just don't know. There's no civil order, especially in the north, and as a result of that, there's no control over those drops and who receives it.
Hmm. And there's concern by Israel, its officials, saying they don't want this food to get into the hands of Hamas as well. So that's another risk, it says, of these airdrops. But John, you know, you talk about need more trucks, and we've been hearing that for, you know, 5 months now, that more aid needs to get in by ground. What does that suggest, that the world community has been ineffective in at least convincing Israel to let more aid in by ground? What does that say about the clout of the U.S. and its allies?
Well, it's really the U.S. we're talking about. Its allies don't have much clout over Israel, but the U.S. does have clout. And what it says is that the U.S. is not prepared to do what it needs to do to force Netanyahu to open up the borders and get this this humanitarian assistance in. Netanyahu, of course, is being pressured by his right-wing coalition ministers not to do that. And he, I think, up until now at least, thinks that maintaining their support and maintaining himself in power is more important than getting food into the millions of starving Gazans.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has said that Israel is deliberately blocking essential aid into Gaza. It's an accusation that aid is becoming weaponized and politicized. To what extent do you agree with that kind of assessment?
Well, at the beginning of the war, right after October 7, there was an actual siege. And as I've said, they need 500 trucks. For a period, 200 trucks were coming in, but most recently that number is way down. Senator Van Hollen of the U.S. was there, and he called the inspection process for humanitarian assistance arbitrary. So I don't think Israel is doing all it can to get that food in. I think that's pretty clear, because if they wanted to, and their pressure is increasing, they would open up the gates.
Hmm. I want to ask you about the incident that happened a few days ago when the trucks with aid on got into Gaza, and we saw what happened from that. The Israeli military announced today that it's going to open an inquiry to examine the incident to prevent it from happening again. It also said it stands by its initial assessment that most people died from swarming, that its military did not fire on them. Should investigators from other countries be taking part in investigating what happened, given that, you know, 112 people were killed, 700 plus were injured, to give those findings more credibility?
Yes, they should, but it won't happen. Hmm. Israel's not going to let international investigators come in. I don't recall them ever allowing it before, and I don't think it's going to happen now in the middle of a war. And even if it wasn't in the middle of a war, they will do their investigation themselves. Hopefully it will be objective and real. I really don't expect to see anybody else coming in at this point.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Allen, Senior Fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, as well as a former Canadian ambassador to Israel. And we're, of course, talking about the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas and the impacts it's having. John, let's talk about Canada for a bit. So Canada says it's also going to do airdrops. It won't do it itself with its own planes, but probably through the Jordanians or other. But Canada is going to supply stuff for these airdrops. Along with that, these past couple of days, I would say handful of days, is I've been watching Foreign Affairs Minister Joly. There seems to be a stronger, at least, tone coming out of what the government is saying about how Israel needs to do more to protect and help civilians in Gaza. I know policy-wise, we haven't changed course, but at least the tone seems stronger to me. I don't know if you agree with that, but if you do, what is that signaling to you about Canada's position?
Well, I do agree with you, and I think it's generally been growing stronger, as has the tone of the leaders of the European Union, foreign ministers. It's a growing frustration with the lack of humanitarian assistance and to some extent concerns about what's happening in Rafah and these threats that there might be a ground invasion before Ramadan if there isn't a hostage deal. So the international community in Canada, of course, is concerned going forward. We're moving into month five of a war. This is the longest war in this area since 1948, 30,000 deaths and many, many thousands of injured. So people want to see an end to it as quickly as possible, and they want to see people on the ground being dealt with. Mm. So there is frustration.
As you say, 5 months into this, there are still dozens of Israeli hostages being held. Hamas' fighting abilities have been diminished, certainly, but rockets are still being fired into Israel. 30,000 Palestinians killed, 70,000 injured, not to mention the 1,200 Israelis who were killed on October 7th. Gaza is utterly destroyed, John. Civilians are starving. There doesn't seem to be a kind of firm end in sight. So as a former ambassador, you know this part of the world. You know things about diplomacy. How are you thinking about where we are at this point?
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful that the negotiations that are ongoing right now in Egypt to secure a six-week ceasefire, a temporary ceasefire, that would see the release of women and injured and elderly hostages who have been in a horrible situation ever since they were grabbed on October 7th, and that would see more humanitarian aid coming in, significantly more. So if you can get those negotiations to succeed and have a six-week break when this can happen, that can also possibly lead to a longer-term ceasefire. I know there are difficulties. Hamas wants a permanent ceasefire and wants Israel to leave, and Israel wants to retain the right to try and go after the political and military leaders. But let's have 6 weeks of ceasefire and get people released and get food in, and then perhaps there can be further negotiations that will lead towards the end of this conflict.
Yeah, the reporting this morning, at least thus far this morning, as these talks continue in Egypt with Hamas, don't know if Israel is there, but is that Israel has generally agreed to the framework of the deal that you sort of outlined there, and we have to wait and see if Hamas agrees to it. Short of that, if they don't get a deal, John, like, where do you sort of view this going?
Well, I think the threat that Israel was making to do ground invasion and bombing in Rafah may have passed in a way. Haaretz is reporting that they don't have enough troops in the area right now to engage in such an operation, and clearly nothing has been done to move the millions now of Gazans that are in and around Rafah. So I can't see there being a ground invasion by Ramadan. But if there's no hostage deal, then I do think that Israel will continue to bomb and use artillery in the south, in and around Rafah, and more people are going to die. They have not yet assassinated any of the three major leaders, and they want to do that at a minimum in order to declare some kind of victory.
We are seeing that Benny Gantz, top Israeli cabinet minister, coming to Washington for talks with U.S. officials, I think including Vice President Kamala Harris. This has sort of sparked a rebuke today from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, according to the reporting, kind of exposing the cracks in the Israeli government. But Benjamin Netanyahu saw a huge protest last night. I mean, there have been many in Israel, but in Tel Aviv, I think it was one of the biggest. But he is, John, still the prime minister of Israel, and he says Israel will fight until they achieve total victory. Does there need to be some kind of pressure from the U.S. in terms of maybe, I don't know, nudging, pushing Benjamin Netanyahu out in a way, or at least suggesting, hey, it's time to go because maybe we have a better partner with Gantz or someone else?
Well, I think you've hit on it, and I think that's why the Americans have invited Benny Gantz and not Bibi Netanyahu to Washington, because they know what Bibi's going to say. And they also know that while Gantz doesn't hold the full reins, even if he were to leave the war cabinet with his party, Bibi would still have four seats to keep his majority safe. But if Gantz were to begin to show daylight on the policy, on the idea of defeating Hamas entirely, and if he were to leave the cabinet, then you would see those protests, I think, increase in Israel, more pressure on Bibi to resign, who's taken no responsibility so far for the war. And perhaps that's the way the United States has decided to go at this, by dividing and conquering, and hoping that that Gantz will show daylight and perhaps leave the war cabinet.
John, you were the ambassador to Israel. I was there at the same time in those years between 2006 and 2010 in Jerusalem. And I remember, you know, Tony Blair coming in all the time as the Middle East envoy, trying to solve what this intractable dispute for years. There's so much talk about what happens after all this. And I'm just wondering, given your experience, how you're thinking about a longer term future.
Well, the one glimmer of hope in all of this is that the idea of a two-state solution is now very much back on the international agenda. It's not on Bibi's agenda, but it's very much seen as a future reality now, because there's an understanding that managing this conflict is no longer possible. October 7 can happen again. It can happen from the West Bank. It can happen from Gaza. And you've got Hezbollah in the north. So we've got to move to a more responsible solution, create a political horizon, do what's necessary to build up the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, free and fair elections there, and get some governance into Gaza and eventually some elections there. It's going to take time, and it's going to take leadership, not the current leadership either in Ramallah or in Jerusalem. But let's hope that, you know, in the short to medium term, we'll see changes in that leadership and people who at least want to create a horizon for peace.
Okay, John, we'll leave it there. I appreciate so much your time this morning. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
John Allen is a senior fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. He was also the Canadian ambassador to Israel from 2006 to 2010. Thank you.
I'm Nala Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
So if words are a measure of how deeply humans value something, then truth must be deeply cherished. So writes Mitch Albom. Just think about all the expressions that have to do with it. To tell you the truth, can I be honest with you? No lie. The fact is, the sad truth, the undisputed truth, the truth of the matter. But do we humans really value the truth? And to what end? These questions are at the crux of Mitch's latest book. It's called The Little Liar. It's a sweeping novel that spans the Holocaust and an often terrible arc through much of the 20th century, exploring notions of truth, hope, revenge, and forgiveness. And just like his best-selling memoir, Tuesdays with Maury, and many subsequent books, Mitch explores human feelings set against a backdrop of pain and suffering. Mitch Albom is here with me. Mitch, it's good to meet you in person.
Thanks, Pia. Good to be here.
So the title of the book, The Little Liar, is a reference to the main character, a kid named Nico, who is known initially for telling the truth, but then through a big deception, tells a big deadly lie, which paves the way for many subsequent lies in his life. How did you come up with the story of The Little Liar?
So I was at a Holocaust museum in Israel about 10 years ago, and they had videos on the wall of survivors telling little accounts of different things. And one of them was a woman who said, people are always asking me, why did you get on those trains to the concentration camps if you knew that they were taking you to your death? Why didn't you fight? Why didn't you resist? And she said they didn't understand that we didn't know that the Nazis would take Jewish people and under the threat of killing their families would say to them, you need to stand on the tracks and lie to these people and tell them that they're going to a good place and they're going to be fine or else we'll kill your family. And so they trusted them and they went on. And I remember being so struck by that when I saw it and just thinking that that's a unique form of evil, to use your own people and the sense of truth that you can trust somebody against you. So the germ of the idea kind of began there, sat in my brain for 3-4 books that I wrote, you know, on other things. And I never could figure out how to make a story out of it until I decided to make it a boy who had never told a lie in his life. And because of his honesty, when the Nazis invade his town in Greece where he lives, and they find out that he's known in his neighborhood as never telling a lie, they decide to use him as a weapon, and they do exactly that. They say they keep him from his family, and they say, well, we'll let you go back to your family after you help us do this little thing. These people are going to be confused. They're going to be getting on trains. Just tell them they're going to a good place and they're going to get jobs and they're going to be with their families. They'll be happy to hear it. And then you can go back to your family. And he does this for several weeks until on the very last day, he sees his own family being shoved inside one of these boxcars and they scream and he finds out that these trains are actually going to Auschwitz and that the first lie of his life is going to be the worst lie of his life. Hmm. And, you know, I wanted to make a parable about truth and lying. I didn't necessarily want to write a book about the Holocaust per se, but it turned out that that was a great backdrop if you're going to do a book about truth and lying, because the truth was never more abused, at least in recent history, than during that time.
And so you wrote this book over the last number of years. And as you said, like you sat, this germ of an idea sat with you. I'm wondering, though, when you got down to it, was there something that you were seeing in the modern world about truth that said, yep, this is the time, this is, because you write about a lot of things, this is what I want to write about.
Yeah, there was. I mean, I think certainly in Canada, obviously where I live in the States, truth has become a very relative thing for people, everybody, even the phrase my truth has become something that people kind of brag about. And it's a bit of an odd phrase to me because you can't have individual truths, there's one, right? But we pick our cable news channel and we kind of view the world through that and we don't want to see the other ones. And we have a very social media following that what we do is just that view of the world. And so people's sense of what is true and what is not is getting very skewed, you know, and the polls that come out about, you know, percentage of people who believe this or believe that is shocking sometimes, whether it's about politics or even about the Holocaust. You know, a recent poll showed that 1 in 5 Americans believe the Holocaust was a myth. I mean, it's 1 in 5. So, you know, I started to think now is probably a time to do these. I kind of do that anyhow, Pia, with my books. I sort of pick a theme that I want to do and then wrap a story around it, which is maybe a little different than other authors. They kind of start with the characters and the plot and the story. I always say, well, what's something that I wanted to, when I'm done with it, I want to say, yeah, I said that about that. And, you know, I did that with the 5 people you meet in heaven. I didn't want to write a book about heaven. I wanted to write a book about people who don't think that they matter in life. And how can I prove that they do? I ended up creating a story about heaven. I did a book recently called The Stranger in the Lifeboat, which wasn't supposed to be about people stranded in a lifeboat. I just used that because I wanted to write a book about belief. And The Little Liar, I wanted to write a book about truth and lying, but it ended up, you know, starting in the Holocaust and going for the next 40 years of the 4 characters' lives.
Yeah. You know, it always reminds me of, like, nowadays we hear my truth so much. Yeah. It wasn't so long ago we just said the truth.
The truth.
Or the fact, right, was actually something we didn't debate and disagree of. It was a fact.
Right. You had to work your way around that, but you couldn't change it. Now we have the sense that we can just change it. And I think, Pia, that comes somewhat from social media's sort of intrusion into the, what should we call, the fiction of our lives. So we can invent names for ourselves. We can only post pictures that are really good and get rid of the bad ones. You know, there's nobody ever posts an ugly picture because they take 14,000 of them. And we're just sort of shaping the way that the world views us, even the phony names we use on social media and things like that. And we hide behind, you know, our screens. And it's a very dangerous thing for the truth. And I don't see it getting a whole lot better.
Let me ask this question about you then, Mitch Albom, because we're all sort of like, you know, swimming in the sea that you're sort of setting out here.
Yeah.
How are you just sort of feeling about the state of the world?
Well, I'm a hopeful person. I've been ridiculed for that a little bit. I remember that there was a critic once wrote a review of me just kind of taking me apart. And at the end, he wrote, he's just the king of hope.
Pretty good compliment,
which
actually,
I thought was actually pretty good throne to be sitting on. You know, I'm all right with that. And so I feel that people have inside them the capability of being better. I do a good deal of charity work in my life at this stage of my life. I spend 1 week every month in Haiti at an orphanage that I run. And I've seen life much worse than we have it here in Canada or in America. I've seen abject poverty. And I've seen the hope that comes out of that from the kids that we work with and take in. And, you know, I've watched them go from abandoned under a tree, left to die in the woods with no birth certificate, no name, no identity, to medical school. And so I'm a hopeful person, but I think, you know, hope is taking a beating right now. And I'm hoping that maybe we come to our senses about how we're treating one another and how we're treating the truth.
The opposite side, of course, of the coin to truth is lies, which also this book explores. And the narrator of this book is a character called the Truth and speaks directly to me as the reader. And so at one point, the narrator says, you write, some lies are easier to believe than the truth, which I had to sit with for a bit and kind of like mull that over. Like, what are you getting at there, Mitch Albom? So what were you getting at there?
Well, I think that's pretty obvious. I mean, the ones that we want to believe, we find easier to accept. If we see somebody that somebody tells us, you can't trust that person, he looks like somebody we don't trust, and somebody tells us some lie about him, yeah, that must be who that person is. It's a lot easier than just getting to know them and find it out, you know, or the reason that this happened must be blah, blah, blah. And it can go from the smallest thing up to where did COVID-19 come from? You know, look at how many theories there are about that. And people choose to believe certain things based on kind of how they're oriented, you know. So the character of the truth was pretty interesting. I really think this book, The Little Liar, kind of came together once I made that decision. I always say that there are two really big decisions you have to make when you're going to write a book. One is, you know, what's the story? And the second most important decision is what's the voice? And who are you going to tell it in? You know, think of like Catcher in the Rye, if they decided to do that third person. It wouldn't, you know, nobody be talking about it today because it was the voice of Holden Caulfield that stayed in your mind. And I was trying to figure out how to tell this story because it was a sweeping story. As you pointed out, it covers 40 years and four characters. And I tried it in first person. I tried it in third person. But when I came up with this page, I just sort of sat down and said, you can trust the story you're about to read. You can trust it because I'm the only thing in this world you can trust. I'm the shadow you can't outrun at the end of your life, the mirror that holds your final reflection. I am truth. And this is a story about a boy who tried to break me. You know, and I wrote that and then I read it and I said, yeah, I would turn the page on that book. So I said, okay, I'm going to stay in that. And the whole rest of this book becomes narrated by the voice of truth, who was able to say during that period of time when the Nazis took over and people were believing the lies of Hitler and the rest, look at what you did to me. Look at how you destroyed me. Look at how you abused me. Why would you treat me this way? You know, and you can only have that voice and be that admonishing if the conceit is, well, truth is telling you the story. So truth has earned that right to say it. You can't have a character doing that. Even people would say, oh, it's obnoxious. But when it's a virtue gets to be virtuous, right? And so it helped make the book what it is.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm joined here in our studio by celebrated author Mitch Albom. We're talking about his latest novel, which is called The Little Liar. I wondered to myself, Mitch, if I had read this even, say, I don't know, 8 months ago, 7 months ago, if it might have resonated somewhat differently with me and with readers, because this has come out at a time of the Israel-Hamas war, now heading into month six. It's a time of rising anti-Semitism. We know that that has been rising over the years as well, but it's a really urgent challenge we're all facing now. So as you sit with what you've written, what parallels or similarities are you seeing between what is happening today and the lead up to the Holocaust?
Well, anti-Semitism comes around a couple of times every century. We always act like it's brand new because how could it happen? But if you historically go back and look, Jews were blamed for the bubonic plague, you know? So it's nothing new, but the excuse of blaming Jewish people for something that people aren't happy about, that's when it gets really dangerous. And that's the pattern, unfortunately, that repeats. And what happened in Germany in the late 30s was, you know, a rise of a despot who said, it's the Jews' fault. If we get rid of them, we'll be better off. And people started to believe that because when you're not happy and when life isn't good and you're looking for a scapegoat and you're looking for somebody to blame, it's you don't want to be that target because everyone goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's it. And then it becomes a mob mentality. And there's some of that going on now. Some is towards Israel and some is straight towards Jewish people. And, you know, trying to divide between where one begins and one ends is impossible, but it's also the insidious nature of it because, you know, every time you call it anti-Semitism, they say, no, it's anti-Zionism. And every time it's anti-Zionism, no, it's anti-Semitism. I did not know when I wrote this book that it would be, you know, pertinent in that way. You know, I wasn't trying, as I say, to write a Holocaust-based book. But what happens to Nico, there's four characters in the book. There's Nico, the little boy. There's his older brother, Sebastian, who is nowhere near as honest as his brother is and who has a heartbreaking 14-year-old crush on a little girl named Fanny, who's 12, and she has the same crush on Nico. So it's a little love triangle there in junior high.
That plays out over the years.
Yeah, that plays out over the years. And then the Nazi, Udo Graf, who tricks Nico. And the book follows all four of them from that moment when that lie is told for the next 40 years. Sebastian gets sent to the concentration camps with his family and manages to survive, although none of the rest of them do. Fanny gets sent to the concentration camps but is thrown out a train window and escapes and has to live on the run for all that period of time. And Udo becomes the head commandant of Auschwitz. And Nico spends the whole war trying to find his family to seek forgiveness. And that's the other big theme, Pia, of this book that I wanted to get across, which was forgiveness. What would you do, sort of, if I had to say, well, what's the essence of the book in a question form? It would be, what's the biggest lie you ever told? And what would you do to be forgiven that lie? And Nico spends the whole rest of his life trying to be forgiven in his own weird way. He becomes a pathological liar because he can't face the truth of what he did. He starts making up names and passports and identities. He moves about the world, always changing his job and his name. And of course, if you can be a brazen liar like that, he comes to America and becomes immensely successful because, you know, if you can lie, you can really succeed. And he becomes, you know, rich, but a recluse, always hiding what he knows, feels guilty about, and always trying to make up for it. And it ultimately becomes a hopeful book. I hope you feel the same way, because I don't want to scare people off when you talk about it. And you've used words like devastating. And
fair enough.
Like, who would want to pick that book up? but it has a hopeful ending, and it does have, you know, some inspiration from it, because in the end, forgiveness and hope do triumph, and do prove to be the true things in life, as opposed to the lies that kind of dominate the story.
Not just saying this, I did love this book, and there's a lot of themes. And I did walk away so thankful to have spent time with it and kind of thinking about these bigger themes of forgiveness and truth. And yes, but still devastated by all that, because these values, these emotions we carry, when we interrogate them, they can lead us to be devastated.
Yeah. Well, you asked me about, you know, how I feel about the world. And there was a scene that I created in this book based on my conversations with survivors from the Holocaust, of which there are fewer and fewer and fewer. I mean, it's just so, if I had done this 10 years ago, I would have had so many more people I could have talked to. But there's a moment where the grandfather of the family, who's kind of the patriarch, you know, they've all been sent to Auschwitz. They're in the concentration camps. And at the end of the day, every day, he gathers his family members and some of the other people around and insists that they each say one good thing that happened to them that day that they're grateful for. And you would think, like, in a concentration camp, how on earth could you do that? And they go around, and one says, well, I got an extra spoonful of soup. One says, my rotted tooth fell out. And one says, the guard who always beats me, he wasn't on today, so I didn't get beaten. And one says, I saw a bird. And what is it in the human nature that makes us search for that one positive thing in a life, in a day that doesn't have any in it? And it was in Viktor Frankl's book, which I reread again, of course, A Man's Search for Meaning, where he wrote, the only people who survived were the ones who believed that somehow tomorrow it would be better. The ones who said, this is hell and we're never getting out of it, they all died. It didn't matter what the circumstances were, they died, whether they died by somebody else's hand or they just died by giving up. And that belief that tomorrow will hold something that's better than today is what I cling to, is my worldview.
Where did you learn that?
Family, you know, Maury from Tuesdays with Maury, you know. I mean, every week for months, you're visiting a man who's dying. You know, right from the very beginning, he's dying. And yet you walk away from the day that you spend with him feeling like the world is a wonderful place. It has an effect on you. Mm-hmm. Then you write a book to pay his medical bills about that experience, and maybe you think it's going to fade, and then suddenly this book becomes a book that, I mean, nobody saw Tuesdays with Maury coming. Nobody. I mean, including the dozen publishers who told me, take a hike. Nobody's interested in it. It's boring. It's depressing. I mean, we could only found one publisher was even interested in Tuesdays with Maury. And they printed 20,000 books total for the world, and I thought I'd have them in the trunk of my car the rest of my life, giving them out at Christmas, you know. But when suddenly a book like that catches on and everybody in your life outside of your family wants to talk to you about that, and you're reliving it and retelling it and retelling it over and over again, that worldview starts to become your own. You know, you can't talk about it and live it and write about it and experience it. And you know, for years, and it's been 28 years now of me talking about my time with Maury, it has become a bit of a skin, you know. And so I just feel positive about things. And I just feel that no matter what, there's always hope.
It's a gift, huh?
It's a blessing, for sure.
Yeah. I don't want to give too much away about The Little Liar, but one of the other big themes is revenge. And I want to talk about that because, again, connected to all the truth, the lies, the reconciliation is revenge. I'm just trying to think. I guess the question is revenge against perpetrators justified?
Revenge is a sub-theme in the book in an interesting way, because Sebastian, for almost all the story, wants to take revenge on his brother, because he feels that his brother lied on those train platforms and was responsible for them being tricked into going, and that his brother was somehow working with the Nazis, which he wasn't. And he becomes a Nazi hunter, essentially, to track down the evildoers, but also to get his brother. And decades pass by, and he can't let it go, and it's all wrong. He's based all this fervor and energy that he's putting into revenge on someone that didn't actually do him wrong. And that's one of the dangers of dedicating yourself to revenge. You think that it's going to solve everything, and it doesn't always. And so do I think revenge is sometimes justified? Yes, I can't deny that, you know, in terms of murders and things like that. I understand why people want to see it done. On the other hand, my experience with it is it's never as satisfying as you think it's going to be.
Except for the pickle of revenge, and this comes out in your book, is that someone might be revengeful, but they see it as fixing an injustice or search for justice.
They see it as justice, right. And, I mean, we have justice systems that do that. I mean, your justice system, our justice, the same way. Is that revenge, or is it, you know, you did something, you have to pay for it? And those who say, well, don't make people pay for it, or don't make them pay for it for that long, or don't make them suffer because you have to have compassion and forgiveness or whatever, take one view of it. And others say, no, you did the deed, you pay the price, and that's what it is. Take a different view of it. I'll just leave it there. I'm not qualified to pass judgment on it.
Let's get back to the truth, because you write about, I have dog-eared pages as I read your book, and one of the biggest dog ears is when you talk about this idea of universal truth. And you talk about grief, and so there's a universal truth in grief. And if there is, as you suggest, that there is a universal truth of grief and loss, and this is a universal collective understanding of this, then can we also get a collective understanding of empathy?
Well, I do think that there are things that are universal that way, and empathy, I do think, is one of them, as is loss. And I think the more we experience loss, the more empathy we have. Again, I'll go back to Tuesdays with Maury. I remember an incident with Maury where we rarely watched any television during those visits. He had a black and white set in his office. But for one reason, he had it on this day, and there was some war scene from, I think it was Bosnia at the time, some mid-90s. And he watched it, and he began to cry. And I said, why are you crying? He said, well, this is just awful. These people, it's just awful. What's happening to them? And I said, yeah, but you ever been to Bosnia? No. You know anybody there? No. I said, so why is this affecting you this way? He said, Mitch, when you really realize you're going to die, not just a theoretical thing, but, you know, your days are numbered, you have such empathy for the suffering of everybody else. And I feel things that I never felt before I got my diagnosis, you know, that I am able to empathize with people in a different way. And I believe that that exists in all of us underneath the surface. And it just takes an event or a triggering thing to go through. The orphanage that we have in Haiti, where I go every month, we ended up adopting one of the children there when she had a brain tumor, a little girl named Chica, and she was 5. And, you know, we thought that we could save her, and we brought her to America. And for 2 years, we traveled around the world trying to save her. But in the end, she had a terrible brain tumor, and nobody ever survives it. It's called DIPG. And she died. And many things happened to me as a result of that in my emotions and all. But one of them is that my empathy towards anyone who has a child or struggling with a child is sky high. And it wasn't necessarily that level before. So why? I'm in the same person. Why did it change? Because some level, something was stripped off of me that, you know, that was sitting on top of it. But it was always there. You can't invent it. And I believe that we all have that. And if we just spent more time in situations that make us empathetic to other people, like working with the poor, working with orphans or whatever, you would find that the empathy's inside you. It's just you got to peel the wrapping off of it. And so I do think that empathy is a universal trait, because loss and love are universal traits. And those things are part of the stew that make up empathy.
I'm sorry you lost Chica.
Yeah, I am too.
You know, you said a little while ago, and I can't remember exactly how you put it, but whenever you sit down to write a book, that you want people to kind of walk away like, this is the thing, this is, I can't remember exactly how you put it, but what is the thing with this book that you want us to walk away with?
That truth is precious, and that forgiveness is divine in its own sort of way, and that no matter what, hope can prevail. I mean, those are the three sort of takeaways from The Little Liar.
It's a beautiful book.
I'm so glad you read it, Pia, and I'm equally, no, even more glad that you liked it.
I did. And so will many of our listeners. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Mitch Albom's latest novel is called The Little Liar. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. This is The Sunday Magazine. And now, my friends, it is time once again for our monthly contest of quick wits, lateral thinking, and improbable knowledge of weird jargon from sailing to chicken farming and everything in between. Yes, it is time to play That's Puzzling. Supposing you find the answer to who did he do the things to do? The puzzle is still as a puzzle of you. Is what is it that has to be done as a puzzle in song? Each and every month, I take on one of my CBC colleagues, as well as a super smart listener of the Sunday Magazine, in a series of word challenges. And those puzzles are devised in a dank underground lair by the man who brings the fun and the suffering. So mashed together, he's the king of fuffering. Hi, Peter Brown.
Hello, Pia. Welcome, Pia, to a very special edition of That's Puzzling, a very Saskatchewanian edition of That's Puzzling. Listeners will know that you grew up in Saskatoon, as did I, but that's not enough Saskatchewan for That's Puzzling. Joining us now in our Regina studio, The host of CBC Saskatchewan's morning show, The Morning Edition, Stephanie Langenegger. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello, Peter Brown.
We worked together in the previous millennium, and now you're getting up at 3:40 in the morning because you do a morning show, and I'm getting up at 3:40 in the morning because I'm old and I have to pee again.
We started working when you were doing some comedy pieces for The Morning Edition.
That's
so it's
right.
Nice to talk with you again.
Nice to see you. So how have you been 32 years later?
We got to move on, people. I'm kidding. Southern Saskatchewan versus Northern Saskatchewan.
That's right.
Pete.
Stephanie is representing Regina. Pia grew up in Saskatoon.
Wait, hold on. You keep saying I grew up, like I just left, and like my folks still live there. My three best friends still live there. I still am of Saskatoon.
Pia's soul still lives in Saskatoon. So right here, right now, we're going to decide Regina or Saskatoon, which is better.
Saskatoon.
I will be the impartial judge.
You're the Davidson.
I am the Davidson.
For people outside of Saskatchewan, Davidson is a midway point when you drive from Saskatoon to Regina. But for people outside of Saskatchewan, also know that Saskatoon is the much better city.
Wow. And so it begins. Stephanie, given that you're representing all of Southern Saskatchewan, are you a puzzler?
I love puzzles and games. I'm a little bit poor under pressure, but I'm super competitive, so that ought to make up for it.
You're going to fit right in. Poor under pressure and competitive is the exact skill set you need for today. We are going far afield for our final competitor. They won their spot in today's game by taking on our listener challenge. We asked you to invent a term for realizing you care about the Oscars, even though you haven't seen any of the movies. And our winning entry is
Imposter Syndrome.
Imposter Syndrome. Well done in a magnificent deep voice by our winning listener, Jim Danahy, in Quispam Sis, New Brunswick. Hello, Jim.
Well pronounced, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go further. What's the correct term for someone who lives in Quispamsis? Is it Quispamsisian? Quispamsister?
Actually, they're derisively referred to by St. Johners as the Valley People.
Ooh. Oh, soon to be a Stephen King movie.
It sounds like it, yes.
Wow. Now, now that you are among the Valley People, you moved to Quispamsis from Toronto, which means you got an extra hour and 45 in your day that you don't have to spend in traffic. What are you doing with all that free time?
Oh, let me tell you, moving to a city with no traffic reporters.
Oh my
if
God.
There's a problem on the bridge, it's on the news.
Wow.
So, yeah, the reduction in psychic energy loss was amazing. Now, we've been coming here for years. I'm married to a New Brunswicker. Our children have been coming here for their entire lives. So it's not new, but it is different being a resident, and it's a pretty wonderful place. A lot of people say it's the Hamilton for Ontario folks of the Atlantic coast, sort of blue collar. It's got no airs or attitudes, but it's spectacularly beautiful on the ocean and two huge, beautiful rivers, bald eagles, all kinds of wildlife.
So, Jim, although I'm from Saskatchewan and I live in Toronto and I love both these places, I have a connection to New Brunswick via my mother-in-law, who summers on Yawhall Beach just outside of Bathurst. And every year or two when we go, I always try and take in a new part of New Brunswick. Last summer, I went to St. John, and we drove out to the burbs, as we like to call them in Toronto, but they're not the burbs, but we came to Quispamsis. Jim, I want you to tell Peter and Stephanie and our listening audience, what's the nickname?
Quispam.
Quispam. Isn't that amazing?
We've got a lot of syllables here because Quispamsis is on the Kennebecasis Valley.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, we're rich in syllables.
Sounds like a good place for a Chattopadi to move in. Rich in syllables over here.
Even a Langenegger.
Yes. If somehow the families could marry, they would be this Quispamsis Chattopadi Langeneggers. All right. We are now ready to put the quiz in Quispamsis. Stephanie, Jim, Pia, let's play That's Puzzling. We start today, as always, with a definition challenge. I am going to give you a word and three possible definitions. One of those definitions is real, two I have made up. My goal is to fool you. Your challenge is to spot the correct definition. Again, one is real, two are fake. Spot the right answer, it's worth a point. Today's word is glabella. G-L-A-B-E-L-L-A. Glabella. Which of the following is a real definition of the word glabella? Is it a microorganism that lives on the ocean floor? Is it the area between your eyebrows? Or is it an ornate pillar in Gothic architecture? So you've got the microorganism on the ocean floor, the space between your eyebrows, or the ornate pillar in Gothic architecture. Which is the real meaning of glabella? Pia, we come to you first.
Peter, how many rounds this season, by which I mean from September to now, of That's Puzzling, have I won?
Zero.
You're supposed to hesitate there for a moment. It's true. Absolutely zero.
Yeah.
Today, I am brimming with confidence.
Ooh.
And when you said glabella, now this could be like me throwing my competitors, but I was brimming with confidence because I know what a glabella is.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, if I didn't know what this was, because I do know what it is. See how I'm doing this? Glabella, it sounds like a medically weird term, like science, medicine kind of thing. So I would lean towards the microorganism. But ornate pillar, like a glabella, sounds lovely. But as a woman who talks a lot with her other women friends about the lines that are starting to appear on our faces, including the glabella, which is that space between your eyebrows. It's eyebrows, babe. It's eyebrows.
Pia seems confident. She is very confident. Her confidence has sometimes been misplaced. Stephanie, what do you think?
Oh, gosh. It's throwing me because I wanted it to be that space, but then I thought it's probably the Gothic pillar. But now Pia has me going back to the space. I'm going to go with the space.
Going to go with the space. Jim, Pia's convinced it's the eyebrow space. Stephanie agrees. What do you think?
I mean, it does sound anatomical, doesn't it? It sounds like something that should be dangling at the back of my throat or something. So I would have thought microorganism as well. I can imagine how it would be part of an ornate bit of a cornice molding and would go with a glabella. But I'm going to go with the pack here and just say it's the space between eyebrows.
All of you are right, and I failed. Uh-huh. Pia was right, and you were right to follow her, and I did not fool you, and everyone is happy but me. So the game's going great. The score is 1 for Pia, 1 for Jim, 1 for Stephanie. So far, it's up for grabs. Now we played round 2. Round 2 is my favorite game, Potato Potato. I am going to give you 2 words and ask you to tell me what other word means both of those things and has 2 different pronunciations. So, for example, if I ask you to give me a kind of fish and a kind of guitar, the answer would be B-A-S-S. Bass is a kind of fish. Bass is a kind of guitar. Spelled the same, but pronounced differently, and they have different meanings.
Do we get fewer points if we need a hint?
No. Hints are free. Great question. I will offer each question to one player. If the first person misses, the others can steal. These are worth 2 points. I will say, this first round is comparatively easy. Mm-hmm. No pressure. Let's play Potato Potato. Stephanie, you're up first. I'm looking for a word that means communicate and a race between teams. Communicate.
Race.
A race between
race
teams.
Race between.
Yes.
Teams.
A single.
Like a match, or maybe I better go to the communicate.
I think race between teams is the more accessible.
Race between teams.
Yeah.
Competition, race, track.
I think I heard Pia squeak, and she might have it.
Great. may I have a hint?
Yes. Which hint would you like? Communicate or race between teams?
Communicate, please.
To communicate, as in to pass along a piece of information. So I tell you something, and you then blank it to Pia.
I tell it to Pia. I share it with Pia. I race to tell Pia.
Yeah.
And the other one, there's communicate, and then there's a match between teams.
A race between teams.
A race between teams. Volley. Meat? I don't know.
I'm going to call it, Stephanie. Now, Pia, stay calm. The first opportunity to steal goes to Jim. Jim, do you have it?
So a race between teams sounds to me like a relay and one type. And then I'm thinking about communicate. So I don't relate.
Jim, just mispronounce, and I use mispronounce in quotes, the word relay.
Relay.
Yeah.
Relay.
Relay. To relay the information. Jim, Pia pushed relay. You through the doorway. A relay is a race with teams, and to relay the information is to
relay
pass along or communicate.
Relay.
It's the same spelling, relay and relay. They feel like The Bachelor. Jim, do you accept these points?
Yes, thank you, whether All I deserve right. them or not. Thank you, Pia.
All right, Jim, we're coming to you for our next one. Jim, we are looking for a word. It's the same spelling, different pronunciations, that means instruction book and what you put on before paint. Instruction book and what you put on before paint.
Can I have that one?
It's not base and bath stuff.
So,
luck of the draw, Stephanie.
What you put on before paint is a primer and an instruction book, at least in ancient times. Used to be primer as well, wasn't it? Then we have those on there. So thinking out loud there, but I'm going to say primer.
There is another way of saying it, the instruction book.
Oh, a primer?
Yes.
Okay.
Primer and a primer. This seems like our mission today, like Jim has thrown a curling rock and we are all just sweeping it into the rings. Jim.
You got to twist me left or right. I'll go where you point me.
So Stephanie would have had that one, and that is luck of the draw, Steph. Jim has 5 points. Pia has 1. Stephanie has 1. There's lots still to play for. Pia, it is your turn at last.
Whew.
We are looking for a word that means a sideboard meal, and there's a hint, or strike repeatedly.
to strike repeatedly.
A sideboard meal?
Yeah.
What is a sideboard? Like that thing you have, like, to what's a sideboard?
So a sideboard is a piece of furniture that might be in your dining room where you put out different dishes.
Yeah, why would I have a meal there? That's what I'm like, does a sideboard have a different meaning? Why am I having a meal on my sideboard?
Why are you putting the food on your sideboard? What kind of meal is that?
Charcuterie? A buffet?
In the spirit of your helping Jim, you have said the right thing.
Buffet.
Yes.
Buffet.
Yes.
Buffet. Oh, God.
Jim has 5. Pia has 3. Stephanie has 1. It's still all possible.
Womp, womp.
One more round to come, Stephanie. You can still do it. It's time now for our final round. We are going to stick with potato, potato. And before we play this round, Pia, I'd like to remind you of something you said at the end of last month's game.
Let's hear that now. And as always, Mr. Peter Brown, thank you for making up the puzzles, for stumping us, or at least trying to. Did okay this time, my friend. I think it'll be harder next time. Oh!
They can be harder next time. Pia, I have spent weeks thinking of the hardest possible potato-potato clue. You'll be happy to hear I did not use it this week. It is unionized and unionized. That's what you pushed me to, Pia, just so you know what I'm capable of if angered. But we are not playing formed a labor union and didn't lose any of its electrons, unionized and unionized, because that would not have been good for anyone.
That's a different game. Yeah,
that's a game called I'll Show You, Pia. Yeah. So these aren't that brutal, but they are harder. But they're somewhere between bass, bass, and unionized, unionized. They're in the middle.
Let me remind my contestants what I said at the beginning of this. Peter, how many times have I won this? That's puzzling this year.
Let me just... still none.
Yep, 0.
All right. For our final round today, we are going to stick with potato, potato, as I said. These aren't brutal, but they are harder. We're going to start with Stephanie. Stephanie, we are looking for a word that means suggest and very personal. Suggest and very personal. And there are hints available.
I'm not talking this time. Suggest, suggest, proffer, and very personal.
I think very personal is the more accessible end of this clue, if that helps.
So she gets a free hint personal. And then can ask for a hint?
Yep.
There, Brown? Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's right, Pia. So very personal. Mine. Close.
Getting there.
Closer.
No, that hyperventilating means Pia just got it.
Oh, she thinks. Oh, yeah. I see.
Again, could be throwing suggest, you guys.
Can you tell me what the, because Pia's talking too much, can you please tell me what the clues are again?
Yes, suggest. And very personal. And if you can have a hint for either one of those.
I would have a hint for suggest, please.
You don't come out and say it, but you let on.
Oh. Shoot.
The person, if it was past tense, they blanked.
Imply. They
close.
Imply. Infer. No, I infer what you've implied.
Mm-hmm.
So you hint, you imply, you and the
starts
other one
with the
is...
right letter.
The other one is, he just told you that it starts with the right letter. Just
with the I.
Yes.
The in.
So, yeah. You got the right start. Remember, very personal.
Very
and Jim
personal.
Has told you, Jim has told you it starts with IN because he's quite the quispam Sissian.
Inner.
Close, a close personal relationship could be described as in. That's the sound.
Like I'm in tight. I'm in.
No, it's a...
in. I'm. Oh, I see.
And there's a department in stores for women's wear.
Oh, Jim! I was. I really Stephanie likes... told me to shut up, and so I did until that.
Jim's thinking.
I don't know.
Jim's thinking of blank
know.
Apparel. Oh, Stephanie.
I think Jim is going to deserve.
Let's see. Well, does it go to Jim or does it go to Pia?
It goes to Pia.
I don't need Jim's little egging on there helping Stephanie.
We go to whoever's in second, which is Pia in this case.
So, Steph, get ready to make an audible groan. Intimate and intimate.
Of course.
Oh, sorry, Stephanie. I was so sure you were going to get there. Jim, who received the help from Pia, then tried to pass it along to Stephanie. So now, morally, we are all neutral.
I think someone has to help me out now.
Jim is at 5, Pia is at 5, and Pia gets our next clue. Okay. Pia, your word can mean either play or produce a gain.
Produce a gain.
Yes.
Like repeat?
That kind of word, yeah. Produce a gain. And then there are hints available.
Produce a gain. Play. Ooh, God. Play is going to be hard, I think. I think I should lean on produce again. So if you do something over and over, you're repeating it. Repetition. Produce a gain. Not produce again.
No.
And it's produce again. Produce again. Oh, I'm going to take the hint, Pete.
Okay. Scientists tried to blank the original experiment.
Yeah, replicate, replicate.
No, close.
Okay, say the hint again. Oh, my God, I'm panicking. Can you guys hear me panicking?
Really close.
I'm really panicking.
So it's play or produce again.
And what is the hint for produce again?
And the hint for produce again is scientists tried to blank
the experiment,
the original experiment.
They replicated.
To blank the conditions of the original experiment.
Oh my gosh. Everyone, all 38 million or 40 million Canadians who are listening to the CBC, because that's how many people listen to this show, are yelling at their radio. What is it? Replicate.
You're so close.
I know, Jim. Help me out. You gave Steph the first two letters. What are they?
Yeah, but I'm not tied with him.
Oh, jeez.
You actually, one of your words started with the first two letters.
Okay, replicate. But I have always said replicate. One of my letters started, repeat.
Same two letters at the front.
Redo. Play.
I'm going to close it pretty soon.
I know. Pia. I know. The time's running out.
Play is a little vague. It's to engage in a hobby that you enjoy.
To engage in a... Oh, my God. I'm just panicking.
Okay. I'm going to close it down soon, Pia.
Oh, you got to close down.
And we think Jim has it. All right, Pia. I'm going to give it to Jim. What is it?
I mean, the produce again was the one that helped me with it, because you're redoing something. So I thought recreate and then recreate.
Yep. That is correct. Oh, Pia.
You were so close.
The good thing is we're all from Saskatchewan, so we all honestly believe that next time it will go better.
It's not. Jim's not from Saskatchewan, first of all. And since he's winning, I'm not giving him honorary citizenship for Saskatchewan.
Wow. No, but I am in the other drive-through province. Everyone goes through on their way to somewhere else. So don't we have that in common?
Okay. Jim, you have offered the most help to your competitors of anyone, and yet you hold the lead as you take this last question. If you get this right, you're going to win. If not, and then if Stephanie misses it, Pia has a chance to tie and we go to a tiebreaker. And this will enter its third hour. Jim, I'm looking for a word that means heroic act and take advantage. Heroic act, which is a noun, and take advantage, which is a verb.
Take advantage.
Pia's getting everyone else's but her own.
Heroic act.
Pia, you just got the wrong questions today.
Yeah, so heroic act could be like a feat.
Like that.
Take advantage, or take advantage. So could I have a hint, please?
For which part of the clue?
Why don't we try take advantage?
Yeah, a greedy company might do this to its workers.
So a greedy company might take advantage, might use, might... Ooh, feeling like Pia felt. So they take advantage, might use, so might abuse, use, and then it's got to, I'm struggling.
Sadly, Jim, you do not have Jim to help you. That's your tragedy.
Yeah, but I was carried over in the first two rounds.
Yeah, that's true.
So feet or... Heroic act would be sacrifice or, what other heroic act could...
Give you a few more seconds, Jim, and then the suspense will begin.
Stumped. Got to better hand it on.
Okay. Stephanie, do you happen to know?
Well, Peter, wouldn't it be nice if I did? I still couldn't win, but I dig myself out of the basement.
Okay.
I don't know.
Pia, if you know this, we will tie... And you and Jim will go to a tiebreaker, and then Stephanie will judge who wins. Do you have it, Pia? A heroic act and take advantage is what?
I actually don't know this. I was trying to throw everyone by my fake confidence. But I do not know take advantage as in a company and heroic act. I just can't work it out.
So the answer is A heroic act is an exploit, and take advantage is exploit.
Wait, is Stephanie still with us? Because she is curiously very silent. Are you okay, Steph?
I'm okay, Pia.
Oh, Stephanie. You know, it's hard to say which part of Saskatchewan wins because we all feel like we've also lost a little. But also, congratulations to Jim. It's a Quispam Sissian victory.
Quispam!
Putting the quiz in Quispam. It's Jim, thank you for playing.
Oh, thank you. Pia, you peed it forward in those early rounds.
Oh, very nice.
Thank you, Jim. I love Quispam. I'm going to come visit you next time I'm in that
Please,
vicinity.
There's always a warm bed and a good meal.
Great.
Stephanie, bad luck on which questions you got. Thank you for playing.
Steph, it was lovely to hear your great voice again, although
Sorry I shushed you.
I know, that's fine.
I was panicking.
No,
I was
it's
panicking.
Good. It's good. I need to be shushed from time to time. Also, I do listen to you because I use the CBC Listen app to listen to the morning edition in Saskatchewan.
Thank you, players. Aww. Thank you for listening at home. That was a very emotional round, but I'm glad we played it. I'm glad we came through this together. And that is That's Puzzling.
Oh, boy. Exploit. Okay, well, thank you, Peter and Stephanie and Jim. We'll get better. I'll win this year at some point. We will be back in April with another round of That's Puzzling. And hey, if you want to play along with us on air, you've got to work for it. In honor of our Saskatchewanians and our Quispam Sissian, we want you to invent a word to describe the act of yelling at the radio when you hear your city or province mispronounced. For example, it is not Saskatchewan. Just please stop saying it that way, please. Email your made-up word to sunday@cbc.ca. Put That's Puzzling in the subject line, and please include your phone number. You have until the end of next Sunday, March 10th, to submit your word. The winner will play with us in April and take home a coveted Sunday Magazine mug or notebook. That's it for this week on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. We had additional help from audio tech Juliana Romanek. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.